This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. So let's bring together the weekly news panel. It is indeed a Friday after all. Michelle McQuigg and Joita Gupta are standing by. Hey, good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Dave.
And good morning, Joita.
Good morning, gang.
So we've got more topics than usual today. So we're going to go rapid fire through a couple Canadian stories to get things started. Inflation continues to impact Canadians in many ways. The annualized rate of inflation in April was 6.8%. Director of Economic Forecasting with Scotiabank Economics, Nikita Perilarov, says the cost of groceries and gas are huge drivers.
Inflation is still very hot. The food and energy components are very strong, in part because of the war in Ukraine. So food is up 8.8% and energy is a whopping 26% higher compared to a year ago.
Federal New Democrats are calling for the government to hike the GST rebate and the child benefit checks by $500 each this year. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh says this would help Canadian families struggling with that spike in food and gas.
We're not blaming the government for all the causes of inflation, unlike some other parties, but we are certainly calling out the Liberal government for inaction in the face of what is a serious consequence for people who are having struggles to put food on the table, to pay their bills.
So we're going to kind of go with quick thoughts on this or big takeaways. And Michelle, I want to start with you because there are a million cascading elements when it comes to inflation. But what's your takeaway in regard to inflation's impact and what solutions may exist?
There are a lot of angles to go with here, but I guess my big takeaway is, apart from gratitude that there's no federal election right now, during which this would obviously be the dominant issue because it has such direct impact on people, I think it's interesting to look at what measures governments could or should take to mitigate inflation. There are different schools of thought out there. Some think that governments shouldn't be mitigating inflation at all because it's a sign of economic driver and people need to adjust accordingly. Others feel, obviously, like the NDP, that measures are necessary. I do think that there's probably room for some targeted relief. It's very complicated. When there's talk about lowering gas taxes and whatnot, there's another school of thought that argues that perhaps higher gas prices are the push people need to start getting away from driving their vehicles. So it's really tricky, but I do think it's going to become inevitable that governments do have to take some action. All against the backdrop of the fact that 6.8% inflation, while very high in Canada, is really remarkably low compared to a lot of emerging economies. And the only other thing I will add before I turn it over is that any discussion about inflation, I hope, does not leave out people with disabilities, as it has so often done in the past.
That's my biggest takeaway, for sure. My biggest takeaway is people who are vulnerable are on fixed incomes, right? That there's a lot of other people can do in the market, in the job market, who may have the means to deal with inflation. People with disabilities are other individuals who might be on old age security or other forms of pension, that's a really difficult spot for them to be in. Joita, your thoughts?
Yes, I would agree with a lot of what you both said so far, in that one of the things to bear in mind is that as inflation has skyrocketed, wages have not kept pace. And so for a lot of people, it's meant that their disposable income has shrunk. And people are feeling the pinch, whether it's at the gas tank or at the grocery store. I know my grocery bill has gone through the roof, and it is astonishing to see how much we're spending in a week on groceries. But I think we have to really have a deep conversation about the impact on anyone who's on a fixed income, not just people with disabilities, but let's think about our seniors who've had an especially rough time of it during the pandemic. And for these people, not only have costs gone up while pensions and disability payments have stayed the same, but we have to bear in mind the hidden and heightened costs associated with being elderly or being disabled and how much of an impact that is going to have when inflation goes through the roof in the way that it has. You asked about solutions, and of course, one of the sort of unintended consequences that we've seen is a rise in unionization where workers have really pushed collectively. We saw those stories about Amazon and Starbucks unionizing in the United States. And so one solution, obviously, is, well, join a union. But beyond that, the more classical solutions to deal with inflation have dealt with increasing interest rates as a way to make it more expensive to borrow. But that has other knockoff effects, you know, heightened costs for business. Mm-hmm. It means that mortgage payments are going to go up, and that's going to mean housing is going to go through the roof. And, you know, all of it has already gone through the roof. So there are no easy answers. And I would be interested to see what the government will do here. But I do think the government is sort of in the frame of mind where they are now trying to reduce spending. They've spent a lot of money during the pandemic. And they're kind of hoping that the inflation is a temporary problem brought about due to the pandemic and the war in Ukraine, and that the economy will stabilize in a year's time. Maybe the conflict will wind down, or they'll find other sources of oil, for example, in places like Canada. So yeah. I don't think there are any easy answers. And if there were, it'd certainly be on my pay grade.
Yeah, it's also fair to say 14 years of incredibly low inflation means that when you see a big number like this, we're kind of shocked. People in the 1980s would definitely say, hey, you want to see interest rates? How about 20% on your mortgage? Michelle, I'm sorry. I cut you off when you were mentioning people with disabilities. So I want to give you an opportunity to finish that thought. I'm so sorry.
No, not at all. Honestly, you articulated a lot of it. Just people with disabilities and other people on fixed income are obviously bearing a particularly disproportionate brunt of all this. COVID relief measures were enacted to help a lot of populations on fixed incomes. People with disabilities were a bit of an afterthought, many would argue, in a lot of the COVID measures. So I would just like to see the inflation conversation be more inclusive right out of the gate.
Yeah, I think when we're talking about government solutions here, you do have to be careful, right? Because it can end up being a bigger inflation driver, but targeted measures to certain groups is something that should definitely be on the table from provincial and federal levels for sure. All right, guys, let's jump into another story that has captivated headlines for a couple of weeks in a couple of different senses. But Canada's transport minister says the federal government is doing what it can to fix the problems at major airports. Travelers have been complaining about long lineups and delays for their flights. Omar Al-Ghabra addressed the issue in Parliament.
We're seeing that the surge for demand to travel is putting a lot of pressure on our airports, on our security system. We are making sure that we increase resources. We're working with airports. We're working with airlines to address this issue.
The Canadian Airports Council is asking the federal government to do away with the COVID-19 protocols at customs to clear up the chaos that international travelers are experiencing. Interim President Monette Pascher says the extra steps mean it takes four times longer to process passengers who come through customs than it did before the pandemic.
Getting back to regular travel with these health protocols and testing in place, the two can't coexist without a significant pressure and strain on our system.
And of course, we're also seeing these long lineups for passports that we've seen for a couple months now as well at Service Canada offices. Juwita, my takeaway on this a little bit is kind of like wah, wah. Like, oh no, my airport stay is taking a little bit longer. It's harder to get through customs. Like, it's always hard to get through customs. And they've been making me take my belt and shoes off and like looking at my toothpaste for years to get on a plane. Mm-hmm. So why shouldn't it be a little slow to get off a plane? Although I do empathize that I do not like being in lines. But what's your takeaway on the airport delays issue?
You know, it's funny you should mention the toothpaste and the taking off your shoes, because that's exactly what I was thinking about and how that was brought about because of a serious security incident. Was it 10, 15 years ago now? It's hard to keep track. But I think there's a couple of things here. I do have a certain amount of sympathy for the Canadian Airport Council and their position in that more people are traveling now than during the pandemic, and they clearly don't have adequate levels of staffing to make things go faster. But with that said, you know, the solution is not to take away the testing. Perhaps the solution is to hire more people, if that's doable. But the testing really is our first line of defense, especially when we want to talk about protecting Canadians against new variants. Each of the variants that we've dealt with, Delta, Omicron, what have you, have all come from other places. And so testing at the airport, even if it is randomized, is still our first and best line of defense. So I would really say that I'm still in favor of testing, and I say this as someone who's booked international travel, and I expect to wait around in line. It is a necessary public health measure, but if the lineups are far too long, step one, hire more people so we can process people faster. And step two, this is where the disability conversation comes in. If you are going to make people wait, please bear in mind that not everybody is able to stand for long periods of time. So make sure you have chairs and benches and things like that.
Michelle, what's your thought on the airport delays issue?
Yeah, I'm a bit conflicted on it in that I completely agree that there's still a very strong case to be made for testing to be done. There are still variants of concern out there. There are still global hotspots and travel is increasing. Where I struggle a bit more, though, is the fact that these rules apply and then you come out into communities where there is nothing. And so it seems like there's a bit of a disconnect. And the whole thing makes me wish there was a more unanimity on COVID measures kind of across the board. You're coming out into communities where there are few, if any, remaining mask mandates. The last province in the country to have a mask mandate dropped it last week.
Mm-hmm.
Testing numbers at home are way down. So it's really difficult to get any kind of sense of what the domestic COVID picture is. So it does feel a bit incongruous to me to have rigorous testing or more stringent protocols at a destination point and then very little elsewhere. So hiring more people, I know this is something that they're working on. They've indicated that there would be steps being taken, although it's hard to say how long that'll take before we see the results there. But it seems to me that there has to be a bit of harmonizing between the airport protocols and the ones in the community.
I like the word you just used there, harmonizing, because I find it stunning that it's taking four times longer to get people through simply having to check a QR code on a phone and an ArriveCan app. If anything, that should be making things go faster than the stupid pen and paper they make me fill out every time I get off an international flight in Canada. You know, the real option, and it would cost so much money, is do what America does, which is have you clear customs before you get on the flight. And then you get off the flight and you just like go to your hotel and it's awesome. But you know what? We're going to get bogged down if I go too far into us becoming like America, and I really don't want to become America. Let's go over to Alberta, where Premier Jason Kenney is stepping down as the leader of Alberta's United Conservative Party, eventually. Kenney survived a leadership vote with 51.4% approval, but is going to step down nonetheless. Secretary of the United Conservative Party, Janice Nett, says the results are the results.
I mean, we have to respect the members. We're a member-driven party, and the results are what they are, and we need to move forward. So it's a mandate to move forward. I am personally sad to see Mr. Kenney leave. I believe that he was a very strong leader, and he had the potential to really move this province forward.
So Kenney has called for an expedited leadership campaign to figure out who the leader is, but he will not step down, at least that's what he announced yesterday, until the new leader is chosen. So he is stepping down, ellipses, eventually. Michelle, what's your takeaway from the Jason Kenney story?
Okay, I have to admit, I am kind of fascinated by the state of conservatism in this country. This is an issue that I find really interesting on a number of levels, and this encapsulates it for me. There were a lot of calls for Jason Kenney to step aside, and a lot of them were coming from people who were a little further to the right on the spectrum than he was. Anger over his handling of COVID-19 measures, i.e. his eventual embrace of public health restrictions and mask mandates and vaccine mandates and such, was a source of a lot of the anger. And I think, to me, this indicates exactly how deep the divisions run. If it's this contentious in Alberta, sort of the heartland of Canadian conservatism, I am a little nervous to think about what it will look like on a national scale. And of course, we're facing that because the federal leadership is in contention right now. It won't be resolved until September. But this shows exactly how big the tent has gotten and how difficult it is to corral the various factions within that tent. And I don't honestly know if United Right is kind of possible anymore.
I shared this thought on the air yesterday, so I'll keep it really brief for the sake of time. It simply says to me that the UCP as a concept is actually quite a young concept in Alberta. There was a deep division less than a decade ago between the Wild Rose Party and the Conservative Party, and 51.4% suggests to me that division, that fracture, exists deeply inside that province. Juita, what's your thought on the Jason Kenney saga?
I think that I can occasionally be wrong, because the moment that 51% announcement came out, I said, well, he's going to hang on to this position. But it turned out mere moments later that he ended up resigning or ended up stepping aside as leader. But it's not clear. I mean, one of the things he hasn't actually come out and said he wouldn't do is run again. So he's not quite out of the picture yet. I mean, it would be he's still going to stay on as premier until a new leader is chosen. And there's nothing that disallows him from running in the next leadership race. And 51% means that, you know, for everyone who doesn't support him, there are people who do support him. So he's not done yet. He is someone who I look at his political career, has shown tremendous tenacity as a political leader. So I'm very interested to see what's going to happen with Jason Kenney. The one other thing I'll say on this is love him or hate him. And Jason Kenney is one of those polarizing figures that, you know, there are people who actually just love him or hate him. Love him or hate him. He handled that situation really well.
Mm.
I really thought he came across as poised, as, you know, very gracious, and just showed a great deal of diplomacy in the way that he handled that speech. And what he has avoided is a great deal of attrition on the caucus. Had he not stepped aside, I think there would have been not an open revolt, but people would have certainly resigned just because in a bid to try and force him out. So I sidestepped all of that. And I will say, to Jason Kenney's credit, he handled it really well.
Joita, I love that take. I'd never even considered the possibility that he might just run in the leadership race, call for an expedited leadership race, and then just throw his hat back in. That's an awesome take.
Back in. Yeah.
If I can say, if we've learned nothing from Patrick Brown, it's never, ever count someone out.
That's for sure. You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.